I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. Our guest is award-winning trumpeter, composer, and producer Christian Scott Atunde Ajua. He comes from a musical family in New Orleans, part of the city's Black Indian culture, and has been credited with revitalizing jazz, mixing that city's rich musical traditions with hip-hop and West African rhythms. He calls himself a sonic architect. Here's a song called Diaspora from his second Centennial Trilogy album of the same name. The trilogy pays homage to the first jazz recordings of 100 years ago. Christian Scott Atunde Ajua played the World Cafe last night, and he joins us this morning on Radio Times to talk about his musical roots, his stretch music, where he gets his inspiration, and New Orleans. And Christian, it's a great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
No, thank you for having me.
I always love watching composer musicians listening to their own music and what they do in response. And when that little bass line came in, you started noodling around on the table here.
Like table bass.
Table bass, yeah. When you listen to music, what do you hear?
Oh, man. It's weird because it's really difficult for me to listen to music and do anything else, right? Because I'm constantly trying to break it down, listening through the layers, trying to figure out like what the points of dialogue between the musicians are, you know, trying to find the differences between, you know, when they what rhythms are being played and what spaces and why, you know. So, you know, the vernacular is important to me, the environment that the improvisers are playing over, specifically in jazz, is like really important as well.
Sure.
So there's so many layers to it, you know. So
lots of conversation, lots of talking going on there.
What's great about it is it's always a conversation, even if it's just duo, right? Or if it's just a person, you know, singing with a guitar to you, it's still a conversation in some ways, right? You know, whether or not you're responding to them, you know, in the moment or not, you know, you're usually responding or reacting to what they're saying in your head, right? So so when I'm listening, I listen for a lot of different things. So it depends on the culture of music I'm listening to and what specifically I'm listening for, you know.
You call this stretch music. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've been asked this a million times, but what do you mean by that? And stretch is such an interesting word.
Yeah, well, I mean, it really has more to do with the way we want to live, you know. You know, we always say it's hard to stretch music if you can't stretch as a person, right? And I mean that in the sense that, you know, we sort of live in a time period where the social and cultural, political arenas have been inundated with people that have highly bigoted views. And, you know, if we're being honest about that, you know, there have to be people on the other side of the fence that fight with just as much fervor for, you know, everyone else. Right. And so when I'm talking about stretch music, you know, I give this example a lot. But, you know, if I ask you to visualize a hip hop artist,
sure,
or a Western classical musician or a salsalero, you see all different races. Right. And part of what we don't deal with is the fact that the way that music is disseminated to us traditionally, at least in terms of how it's sold to you, is highly racialized. And
with black people over here, white people over here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing is like, if you, the closer you pay attention to it, it doesn't necessarily mean the people that are creating it or who's listening either sometimes, right? But when you take a moment to sort of to add all of that up, you know, you can come to some pretty terrible conclusions about how we actually see each other, how we interact, how we relate to each other. And so, you know, when I was a little boy, I lived in an environment, you know, that was mixed. You know, I grew up in the Ninth Ward in New Orleans, right? But this is also like the area that had the first desegregated school in the country, William France by Ruby Bridges. This is the school that I went to as a little boy. I could hit it with a rock from my backyard. So to give a bit of context, you had whites in the neighborhood. She desegregated the school, and then blacks began to encroach into the neighborhood. Once blacks got there, some whites left, but some had to stay because they didn't have the means to leave, right, in some spaces. And so you fast forward 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, and you have these people that are living in an area that is, you know, a pretty underserved area, right? This is not an area that the municipality really cares to refine or to cultivate anything in, if I'm being honest. And whether they're black or white, they're still enduring the same thing. So as an example, you have white children that are being undereducated so they could be a labor class, and you have black children going through that. You have white families that have food insecurity, and you have black families that have food insecurity. And for some reason, because of this really topical thing, you know, I think insofar as it is a social construct, we will agree that race exists, right? But only as a social construct, it doesn't exist. Like, there's no Homo sapien Africanus, right? There's only one race of people here, right? And so they reacted to each other as though they were nemesis when really they were the same people. Do you get what I'm saying?
I totally get what you're saying. I mean, it's appealing to the DNA that we all share.
Right? Yeah, it's the thing for me is, you know, if you just hold a conversation with, you know, people from seemingly disparate cultures, you'll find that you have more in common than you don't. So when you ask what stretch music is, it's us reevaluating the way that we communicate and treat each other, and in the musical space as well as in the social space. And so that doesn't happen unless you have a real respect for all these different cultures of music, which means you have to have a legitimate respect for the people, right? No matter their cult, race, you know, what they believe in, what their theology is, their sexual preference, gender identification, where they were born, if they're immigrant, any of these things. So, you know, we try to create a form that feels genre blind, and it's acculturation of other forms and vernacular as a means of creating a better way to communicate.
But do you see this as a form of protest music? Too strong?
No, I think sometimes I get a little bit worried about sort of romanticizing, you know, the sort of political side of what happens. Like, obviously, like, yeah, it's a social music, you know, but it's like I was having this conversation the other day. I played the BBC Proms with the Metropole Orchestra a couple of weeks ago, and we did the music of Charles Mingus. And all over and over, he's so political, 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 political. And I was like, we have to be really careful romanticizing that, because like what you're calling political is just a guy that's being stabbed saying, "Someone help me, I'm being stabbed." Right. So it, on one hand, you could say that, right, about my music. Right. But on the other hand, it's not. Well, what I'm protesting is the notion that we can. There's a lot I'm protesting.
I'm really trying to decode
it. I think what's important to me at this juncture of my musical trajectory and where I am as a person, as a man, is helping people. Conclude for themselves. I know that might sound a little weird, but I think more often than not, whenever I'm talking about a lot of the issues that we talk about or we speak to in our music, whether or not it's a song like Ku Klux Police Department or The Last Broken Heart about Proposition 8 and you know, equality for in marriage equality, you know, I think all of these things are, you'll find, obviously, most of my music is instrumental music.
Yes.
So I'm not telling you what to think, but it's important to us that you think, right? So I think that creating a space that sparks cognition is so what I'm protesting is this space that we live in that sort of drags the listener around right? And says, okay, this is what you're about and what you're not about, and us not actually challenging that, right? So that's really more of what I'm protesting than saying, okay, I'm protesting the American government or I'm protesting these people, right? To me, I think the more time that we actually dedicate to thinking about other people's realities and what they're enduring, the more likely we are to see them as valid and to see their humanity and to see the sameness, right? So, you know, you asked the question about stretch music. It really is about choosing to see the sameness between seemingly disparate cultures of music and to try and figure out ways to marry those things as opposed to keeping them separate, you know?
You mentioned New Orleans and growing up there, and you do come, I don't know whether New Orleans royalty is overstating it, but you come from the Harrison family.
Yes, ma'am.
Your grandfather, your uncle, I mean, these were are important people to that city, and I'm assuming to you as well. What kind of influence do you think that had on you as a kid growing up?
Huge. You know, I was very fortunate to be around, you know, men that were, I mean, the men and women in my family are pretty formidable in some ways, but the guys that you mentioned, my grandfather was a chief. He was a guy that was a chief of four different tribal banners of Black Indians in Louisiana. And my uncle has been chief, and I was just coronated as chief this year too. So,
oh, wow.
So it's, you know, these guys, they're heavy guys, you know, and because of what they're responsible for, you know. Also, it's they come from a culture that's not given a sort of the Cliff Notes version of American history, right? And they also know their own history. So, you know, when you have an alternative narrative to what actually happened here, it's probably going to create a different type of person, you know?
We're talking about the Black Indian
culture of New Orleans.
Right.
Yeah, well, because you think, you know, this is a culture that starts in the 1710s and had to contend with multiple colonial powers, right? And so obviously that history is going to be rife with a lot, you know? And so to be descendant of, you know, these men and to be in their line, you're going to be sort of hit with a lot of information that maybe doesn't get told in a Louisiana studies class.
I hear
right?
you.
Yeah,
I hear
so they
you.
Were great. It was fun.
Let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Christian Scott Atunde Ajua. He's an award-winning trumpet player. He's a composer. He's a producer. As I said, part of this important musical family in New Orleans. And he's working on completed a centennial trilogy, an album this year that pays homage to the first jazz recordings going back to 1917. We're going to play some music from the trilogy, and you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. I'm talking with Christian Scott Atunde Ajua. And let me play another song. This is called Ruler Rebel. It's from the first release of this trilogy, also called Ruler Rebel. Let's give it a listen. And again, a song called, or a piece of a song called Ruler Rebel. I really like that. Mm-hmm. And I can see why you call yourself a sonic architect.
Oh, that's sweet.
I mean, just because you create this mood, this atmosphere, feels very cinematic to me.
Oh, yeah, like environments.
Totally.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you.
What did we hear there? We heard this long, sustained note to begin the whole thing.
Yes.
Then what happened?
So you have... what's cool about this particular track to me is it's a lot of it is stuff that I produced in Logic, different programs, mm-hmm. With my band also playing over it. But some of the instruments, we were really fortunate to get some great players from Berkeley and students. And
you went to Berkeley, right?
Yeah, which was I had an amazing time there. But you heard an irhu, which is a Chinese, like sort of like a two-string, like spiked violin is sort of like the best way to think of it. So this was that, you know, they have a very interesting character,
yeah.
Right? And, you know, when we're mixing all of these cultures of music, some of the cultures that we're tapping, you know, their systems of harmony and their systems of navigating their instruments are quarter tonal as opposed to just a well-tempered system, which is the Western style, right? So, you know, part of what makes the blues is Guy's way of being able to sort of hint at things that necessarily aren't in the grid. And so when you can have East meets West and then sort of the jazz or blues of it be the bridge between those things, I always find those sort of compositional things really interesting.
Yeah. You play the trumpet. When I read mm-hmm. that, I thought, okay, I know what a trumpet looks like.
Right. And then,
I saw your horn.
Yeah,
right. I said, what am I looking at
right.
here? What is
God,
that?
It's funny, man. Sometimes I find myself apologizing because people can be so confused in some moments. So I have my own line of horns. You know, you can find them online if you look up Christian Scott Model Instruments. We have a trumpet type, a cornet type, and a flugelhorn type.
Oh,
so the main horn that I play is sort of like a tilted bell trumpet. It's when you look at it, the bell is high. So most people look at it and they say, that looks like Dizzy Gillespie's horn, right? Now,
because it kind of goes up in
the
air, right?
It goes up in the air, right?
Yeah.
But it's interesting because the instrument works the completely opposite. Right, and Dizzy's horn, he had the last angle that a regular trumpet has and then another 45-degree angle, so there's more back pressure, so it makes it easier to get in the upper register. My horn has one less angle, and the last angle is less abrasive, but this allows me to get inside of the horn and create multiple timbre and texture. So I can whisper into the horn. I can prioritize breath over vibration at the mouthpiece. I can use temperature to actually rub the brass differently, and it's going to give me all different sounds. So all of the horns are built that way. There's a flugelhorn version that's called a reverse flugelhorn. This is like the biggest horn that I play. And then a small baby version that I played last night, which is called a sirenette, which is like a hybrid of a flugel and a cornet.
But designed to give you the kind of sounds that you are looking for.
I hate the sound of the trumpet, and so that was where that started.
Wait a minute. Hate the sound of the trumpet?
I've never liked it.
And yet, that was your chosen instrument?
You know, yeah, honestly, this is always, you know, people are kind of shocked by this a lot, but it's like, I picked the trumpet because it was practical. It was pragmatic. I know that seems weird, but it's like I grew up in New Orleans. You know, I grew up in an area where there are not a lot of vocations that you're eligible for, if we're being completely honest, right? And you know, like we spoke about before, a lot of people being undereducated, so there's people are comfortable in the labor class, right?
Yeah.
Or steered to the criminal fraternity so that you can become a laborer that way, right? So where I'm from, when you're in elementary school, you're in third grade and there's 200 trumpet players. Right. So my uncle is a saxophonist.
Right.
I wanted to be just
Donald
like him.
Harrison Jr.
Yep, exactly. So I wanted to be just like him. But he played the saxophone. So I was like, okay, well, if I play the saxophone, you won't take me on the road. So I'll pick the trumpet. So if I get good, he'll bring me out.
And he did.
And he did. Yeah.
You were, what, a young teenager?
I started with him when I was about 13 years old.
Playing on the road or playing in New Orleans?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is he
my mother
is a jazz master?
Oh, yeah, of course. It was funny. I was saying my mom was like, you know, she didn't want me to be on the road that early. So she was really, you know, serious about my schoolwork and making sure that he was always with me. But yeah, Donald will put you through your paces because, you know, you could argue that he may be one of the greatest, you know, alto men of all time. There's arguments for that. Right. And, you know, his acumen. He played with Art Blakey and Jazz Messengers, Roy Haynes Band, Miles Davis, Lena Horne. So Eddie Palmieri, you name it pretty much he played with. So when I'm growing up, I'm learning these skill sets and these tools from a guy that has not only learned them, but learned them in multiple contexts. So, you know, he's not just drilling you on, you know, when you get the test is also always multiple tests.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Mm-hmm. I've been watching you play mostly on video.
Okay.
And you play hard.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how else to describe it because I'm not a trumpet player, but looks like you know, you got to have
painful.
A strong, is it painful?
No, it's funny. That's what most people react. They're just like, it's like, you got a strong mouth, boy. No, it's funny. It's like, it's weird because I go through waves, right? Because obviously, like, I love guys like Doc Cheatham and Miles Davis because for their ability to, you know, play inwardly. And so I play this way as well. But I think in the moments where my sound may captivate most or the emotionality of the music has the highest potency, I think a lot of those moments, it seems to be more palpable when I'm also enduring something.
Oh, so to put yourself through some tough stuff.
Exactly. You know, so it's like, you know, we were talking about Mingus before. He would always say that his music was designed to sound like struggle because that was what his experience was, right? And I think on some levels our music embodies a lot of those qualities. And, you know, when you're speaking about some of the things we speak about, you know, if you're playing it as a nursery rhyme, it's not going to translate the same way because that moment in someone's life isn't a nursery rhyme.
Yeah.
You know, so I think so the connectivity between those spaces is important.
This question is a bit of a tangent, but I, having been a big fan of the series Treme, which takes place in New Orleans, and in certain ways, some of the storyline comes from your family, the Lambreau family in Treme. But as an outsider watching the actors fake playing their instruments, I thought it was pretty convincing. Now, I don't know.
Rob Brown is really good.
And he's sort of you-ish character.
Right, exactly. He's like the character that's a hybrid of my uncle and I. Yeah.
He was
very good.
Did you teach them how to look like
you're
playing?
They followed us around, you know. They sort of shadowed us for a minute, which was really fun. And it's funny because on one of the episodes, with all of the characters, they had reveals with the character with the person they were based on. So one of the episodes, my band went in to do it, and he played with my band and everything. And it was funny because, you know, I had a couple lines originally, right? And I botched them up rehearsal. No, it was great. I botched them up in the rehearsal, right? And Rob was like, come on, man, this is easy. It's just like 6 or 7 sentences, right? And I was like, I just was real. I was like, you follow me around for months. You know what I'm saying? I'm just showing up at your job. I'm supposed to be able to do your job. And you were like lurking in corners at the Village Vanguard, pantomime and air trumpet, right? So come on, give me a break. He's like, all right, you know what? You're right. I was like, yeah, come on. You know.
So those knives never made it in?
They didn't make it in. But, it's the funny thing is, you know, my brother's a film director and he...
your twin brother,
my
I
twin brother,
add.
Kyle, yeah. And so he's always making fun of me because he's like, I've seen you memorize trumpet concertos in a day, and if I give you, it's, I don't know, something about the way my head is calibrated, you know, a couple lines here, a couple things, nothing bad, but you know, if I have to really, really interact, not so good. So you know, this is something that I need to work on.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Christian Scott Atunde Ajua. He's an award-winning trumpet player. He's a composer, a producer, was in Philadelphia last night, in fact, performing at World Cafe, and joining us this morning on Radio Time to talk about how he approaches, how he thinks about music. Let me read some comments here, and then I do want to play New Orleanian Love Song, only because we're thinking about Irma, we're thinking about Katrina, and all seems to have come together here. Comment from Nick. Christian, in part, I see you as an influence. Are you an influencer who's a jazz musician or a jazz musician who's an influencer or who influences? Or both, maybe.
I don't think of my, you know, like the I find a lot of times the you know, when we use words like that to sort of define what we do, it's like the less accurately we're actually defining what we do, right? When someone says jazz musician, there's a very heavy, you know, history to that, and that could be really wide, or depending on who you're talking to, it could be very narrow. So, you know, I sort of just think of myself as a person who sees things, who creates, you know, and obviously what I do is music. You know, I just spoke about how terrible an actor I am. So it's like it happens through the musical space. But, you know, part of what we do, like I said earlier, is sort of to walk away from these labels, because the labels kind of come from spaces that were designed, you know, with pretty pejorative and belittling things in mind. You know, it's like jazz music. You talk about blues, you talk about rhythm and blues, rock and roll music. Most of that stuff, when it started, was called race music. A lot of people don't know that, right? But so it kind of was clearly articulated to you from the beginning how, you know, the music was seen. So I don't really think of myself in that way, just because I'm a world citizen. I'm influenced by everything that I hear, everything I see, you know, whether it's good or bad, or if I have a positive reaction to it or adverse reaction to it, it's still information, and that's valuable to me. So, I just don't break it down in that way. But I think in terms of the influencer thing, it's not that we're looking to do that so much as I think what we're doing has created a space where people feel less limited. And so anytime you create a space where people feel more free, then more people are probably going to flock to it. And I think that's sort of what's happened in our reality.
Let me just play a little piece from a New Orleanian love song. Mm-hmm. And this is on the Ruler Rebel album, part of this Centennial Trilogy. Just a quick listen. Just a little taste of New Orleanian love song. A couple of years ago, you added Atunde Ajua to your name. How come?
I was uncomfortable navigating the world exclusively as Scott. You know, when I was a little kid, when I'd be sitting in class and they'd say, Mr. Scott, or they'd say, Christian Scott. It was my reaction to it. I felt like something about it didn't feel right. And it wasn't until I got a little bit older and started to study the history of how, you know, people in my culture got their names, that it sort of dawned on me. This is like, really, you know, you sort of think about that as an idea, like Scott's property, you know, and the notion that, you know, in Louisiana specifically, you know, the laws there are really pointed, but, you know, most of the African descent people there, when they talk about those names, they always talk about them from the space of, you know, after, you know, emancipation during the Reconstruction era, their grandfathers and great-great-grandparents being threatened with, if things turned around, being put back into captivity, and them knowing who you belong to because what you're walking around with. So something about it didn't feel right to me. But, you know, I go by Christian Scott Atunde Ajua. The full name is there because Scott was the name that my father gave me and his father gave him. And I love them both very much, you know. And so their contributions to my life are really beautiful. So I wanted to hold on to that. But I also wanted to acknowledge a facet of my history that, you know, predates the American experiment.
Well, we're almost out of time here, and I do want to play one more song from this trilogy. The trilogy really is an homage to music that was performed, composed 100 years ago.
Yes,
you
absolutely.
Want to try to capture some of that?
Yeah, well, we were looking to reevaluate the way that we communicate with the listener in this era, right? And, you know, it's difficult to do that if you don't take a hard look at what happened in the past. Obviously, you know, maybe we need to sort of think about that in the political space as well right now, but it's important to sort of look back to see what's going on to try and figure out the best way to move forward. And we wanted to move forward in a way that also addressed all of the things that grew out of jazz.
And jazz was spelled
J-A-S-S. Yeah, yeah.
From where did that?
Well, my great grandmother would knock the taste out of your mouth if you said the word jazz around her. A lot of older New Orleanians were that way because initially it stood for jackass music. The first jazz recording, J-A-S-S, the original Dixieland jazz band, was satire. right? So a lot of the first practitioners of this music were very serious musicians. They, you know, you brought that recording up, they would cringe because they were being made fun of, right? Obviously, we know what's grown out of the music now. But in the beginning, in its infancy, it was sort of seen as a very base thing.
Christian Scott Atunde Ajua, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. We had fun as well. This is The Reckoning on the Ruler Rebel album from our guest's trilogy. Give it a listen. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. President Trump is a regular visitor to his private golf clubs in Florida, New Jersey, and Virginia, where members have paid as much as $100,000 to belong. It's been a lucrative business for Trump and his family over the years. USA Today decided to investigate the members of these clubs who have literally paid to play on Trump's golf courses and might have business before the government. Since the membership is private and there are no logs about who has been spending time with the president, they use social media to track down the names. We asked Frederica Skouten, one of the reporters on this story, to join us on Radio Times. And nice to have you with us on the show.
Good to be here.
So what sparked this investigation?
Well, we have an extremely unusual situation. The President of the United States, by choosing not to divest himself of his business interest, spends a lot of time with paying customers. And so we decided to take a look at the people with whom he associates. So what we did is we used social media, we used a public website that golfers use to track their handicaps, and then researched and contacted hundreds of members to determine whether they had business with the government. And we found that dozens do and are able to interact with the president.
Tell us about, I guess, what happens at a Trump golf club, a club or golf course. The president apparently is a pretty good golfer. He has gone to his clubs numerous times since he became president. What's the atmosphere there?
Right. He's gone about a quarter of the days that he has served in office. And so these are clubs, for instance, the clubs that we looked at most closely, Bedminster, the club outside Northern Virginia, and clubs in Florida, are the ones that he spent a lot of time at. And it depends on what's happening. Mm-hmm. At Bedminster, for instance, he spent a couple of weeks there on a working vacation in August. He spent a lot of time there during the transition between the election and before he became president. And there is a lot of sort of government business that transpires in front of folks. You know, he had a national security meeting in a stately building that overlooks the pool deck at Bedminster in August. He interviewed cabinet members there. When he golfs, he usually is golfing with Secret Service. Folks tell me that they sort of come and sort of clear the course so that he and his golfing partners sort of move through very quickly. Sometimes they move through the course in about half the time. And then he will often say he's in Virginia, he might have lunch at the facility afterwards. He will pose for pictures, he'll shake hands, he'll greet people. You know, he's still very much, he's the president, but he's also the owner of the facility.
Have you been able to determine whether a member of one of President Trump's golf clubs was able to get either a policy passed or a program passed or something to benefit their business interests because they have been a member of one of his clubs.
No one is saying that at this point. I mean, in fact, many of the folks that we've spoken to say that they don't talk business. But one of the things that has been interesting is the ways in which people are eager to point out their relationship. For instance, there is someone who is a top lobbyist for North American Airports, and when he had a meeting with the president in February at the White House, one of the things he said and was caught on C-SPAN cameras, that he pointed out to the president as he introduced himself that he is a member of his club, to which the president said, good, very good. And the firm where President Trump spent marks the first 100 days of his time in the White House was owned by a member of one of his clubs. But again, people aren't saying like, oh, I got this as a result of the membership. But ethics experts tell us that in Washington, in particular, FaceTime really matters, right? And the casual contact, the ability to say, I met the president, or, you know, maybe have him remember you, is also valuable.
As you mentioned, there were, you looked at something like 4,500 names, were able to identify something like 75 people. How arduous a task was that?
It's very time consuming. You spend a lot of time sort of researching folks to make sure that names match, particularly when names are common. And then you spend a lot of time on the phone trying to chat with folks. You know, many, many people told us that they did not want to talk, but some of them did. It's time consuming, but it's journalism. That's what we do.
Indeed it is. You talk about FaceTime, and in many ways, I mean, that is what lobbying is about, the ability to get in front of someone and, I guess, try to influence either their vote on a particular issue or to interest them in a particular kind of issue. And lobbying is sometimes occupies that gray area when it comes to money and politics. How do you see this at these Trump clubs?
Well, again, I do think that much of lobbying does come down to relationships. And, you know, we're just several months into the presidency. It remains to be seen, you know, how all the policies shake out. For instance, the Airports Council very much wants an increase in the infrastructure fees that passengers pay on their tickets. So right now they're capped at $4.50 per ticket in what a passenger, all airline passengers pay. The airport industry very much wants to see that increased. And so there's legislation rolling through. President Trump has said he doesn't particularly care for additional fees. Let's see how it all shakes out. I can't say that it's a result of that relationship or not, but there are things that people want out of government. There are contracts that people want out of government. And again, President Trump has put himself in a unique position by continuing to own these courses. And he has the ability to accept payments. We know from trust documents that the Government Services Administration released earlier this year related to his hotel in Washington, that although he does not take a salary from the federal government, he turns it over to various parts of the federal government each quarter, he has the ability to draw profits from the trust that controls his business. So, and these golf courses are big money makers for him.
Yeah, how much money have you? And it's interesting because he has not released tax returns, but how much money do you think is being made at these golf clubs?
Well, according to his financial disclosure reports, there are hundreds of millions of dollars over the course of 2015 and 2016 from these golf courses. And again, it's hard to tell how much money he exactly makes. As you point out, he has not released his tax return, so we don't have a sense of precisely how much goes into his pockets, but they are part of, you know, a money-making part of his big empire.
Let me quote something from this report in USA Today. The review shows that for the first time in U.S. history, wealthy people with interests before the government have a chance for close and confidential access to the president as a result of payments that enrich him personally. It is a view of the president available to few other Americans. And that raises a whole host of things, whether what is going on is either legal or illegal or ethical or unethical. Have you been able to determine that?
Right. Well, this is all perfectly legal in terms of there's no prohibition on a contractor, for instance, paying money to a president to be a member of his private club. Same rule for lobbyists. But there are a couple of key points here, right? One is the confidential nature of this. I mean, and that's part of what motivated us really to find out more. You know, President Trump does not disclose the names of the people that he golfs with on a regular basis. President Obama, in pool reports, they generally told reporters, here's who the president was golfing with today when he went golfing. The other thing is the lack of access to the logs about who interacts with the president. Mm-hmm. I mean, the White House has decided not to release Secret Service visitor logs at the White House. We're in a court battle with a couple of nonprofit organizations over releasing logs for Mar-a-Lago, which is, you know, the president has dubbed the Winter White House, his Florida resort. Those groups have won that case, and we are supposed to, as of Friday, be able to see some of those visitor logs.
Oh, interesting.
So there is this cloak of secrecy over who interacts with the president, and it matters because the president, when he's not at the White House or Camp David, he spends his time at his clubs. I mean, almost exclusively. When he dines out in Washington, he dines at the restaurant in his hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue. When he goes on vacation, he goes to one of his clubs. People have very easy and casual access to him at these facilities. And so we thought the public ought to know some more about who was there.
Well, we've had wealthy presidents in the past, and if they had money, it was put into trusts, or I guess blind trusts, while they were president. But it's interesting you use the word customers. I don't know if we've ever had a president who has customers before.
Right. There is no modern precedent for a president to still have customers in this fashion. Now, again, he has put the trust, he's put, you know, his two adult sons and a longtime Trump Organization employee in charge of the business, but he has not divested himself. He still owns it. He still financially benefits from this trust. And there are people who, you know, who knew him beforehand as the proprietor of Mar-a-Lago and these properties, and people come up to him and talk with him and give him advice and chat. And, you know, as we saw in Mar-a-Lago, he conducts a lot of business there. Members posted on social media pictures of him consulting with the Japanese prime minister after the North Korea missile attack at the dining room in Mar-a-Lago in open air.
Right. How does lobbying, though, typically take place? And is it a matter of, I mean, to get that kind of face time that a lobbyist or a business person would want in order, if not talk to the president, talk to members of his cabinet, or perhaps even talk to members of Congress? How does it typically work?
Well, it depends. I mean, there's sort of official and unofficial lobbying, right? What gets written down in the reports that lobbyists file to Congress, and, you know, that involves, you know, going and having a contact meeting with a lawmaker, or more likely some of his staff, to press an issue, to show up with documents, make a case. But then there's sort of this unofficial world of FaceTime and lobbying. And one of the things that happens, of course, is that some people, you know, do lobbying in quotes. You know, they say that they're consulting or providing advice to clients on how to navigate government without officially registering as lobbyists. And we've seen this happen a bit with some of the folks who worked on President Trump's campaign. You know, they started consulting operations in Washington, and they say that they're helping people understand how the president thinks. So it takes all sorts of forms, but I think everyone agrees that having FaceTime and informal contact with the most powerful person in the United States is advantageous if you have business before the government.
And if you're not a member of the club, you're not going to get that FaceTime.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. This is access that few Americans enjoy.
Were people surprised when you called them up about their membership in one of President Trump's clubs?
Yes, some were. You know, how did you find out about me? And others were annoyed. And then others, again, were willing to chat because in some cases they had been longtime members of some of these clubs. You know, particularly in the case of the Virginia Club where President Trump bought it in 2009. So there were people who had been longtime members who were happy to talk about how different it was since he bought it, since he became president. But, you know, there were lots of, don't get me wrong, there were lots of no's.
I can only imagine. I do remember, though, President, or I guess it would be candidate or even business person Trump, complaining about President Obama and how much time he played golf. We're only 6 or 7, 8 months into the Trump administration. Has anyone looked at that, or have you looked at that, Frederica?
Well, he did complain a lot about there's a clear record about that. Seems, you know, unapologetic about playing golf as much as he does. I mean, he has emphasized, for instance, during his travels to Mar-a-Lago and to Bedminster, that these are working vacations, you know, that he is still working. He spent a lot of time with the Japanese prime minister on the golf course, so presumably they were talking about policy. He also clearly wants to get his golf in, and by all accounts, he's a very good golfer and enjoys it. So, you know, I doubt that most people, you know, would criticize somebody who has a very hard job being president of the United States for blowing off steam on the golf course. But yes, he did criticize his predecessor for doing so.
Final question. Are you going to continue this investigation?
Yes. More to come.
More to come. In terms, I know you don't want to spill the beans on the air here, but just sort of following up on leads that came out of this first story?
Yes, yes. That and more.
That and more. Well, we will stay tuned. Frederica Scouten, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Yeah, you too. And she's one of these, one of the reporters on this USA Today story that we saw last week. The title, Trump Gets Millions from Golf Members, CEOs and Lobbyists Get Access to President. Well, that's it for today's edition of Radio Times, beginning with some music, ending with some golf. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org to tell us what you think of the program. You can also download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Bob Alls, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.